Good morning. May it please the Court, Michael Tanaka, Deputy Federal Public Defender, appearing on behalf of Mr. Israel Leal Felix. Mr. Leal Felix was cited for driving without a license on November 17, 1998. 2 days later, he was again cited for the same offense. Those two cases were consolidated for sentencing and received concurrent sentences. The issue before this Court is whether those two sentences count as one sentence or they count as two. And that, in turn, is dependent on whether that citation counts as an intervening arrest under the guidelines. The answer is plainly no. In pretty much any context, the common understanding of arrest does not include a citation. If you ask someone if they've been arrested after they've been, most people who have not been hauled into custody, who have a traffic citation, say, of course.
Now, Judge Easterbrook for the Seventh Circuit came out the other way, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, interpreting a slightly different version of the guideline he did.
But if we were to agree with you, we would have, I mean, there's no principal way of distinguishing that case, right? It's a different guideline, but it's the same issue, right? Principal reason to resolve, to treat them differently, right?
At the core, they're the same issue. There are certainly the change in the guideline might, you could say, changes analysis somewhat, and that informs somewhat the principle behind the guideline, and that is the change in the guideline took out the concept of relatedness, and meaning that what it left in was the concept of just a separate incidents separated by an arrest, which goes more towards a concept of deterrence rather than some concept of just punishment. That is, that there are two related cases, so you should only count as one. Here, the issue is whether or not there is some intervening event that would lead to some, that would have some deterrent impact.
But that event would be an arrest, though. The intervening event in this case was an arrest, right?
The intervening event in the guideline is an arrest.
Right. And obviously that's what we're concerned with in this case, right?
Whether or not there was
an intervening arrest.
That's correct. And the argument, obviously, is that a mere citation is not an arrest.
Do you think most people would feel free to leave while they were being cited?
No, they're clearly detained, and they would not feel free to leave.
Isn't that the classic definition of an arrest, whether or not the person being detained would feel free to leave?
With respect, John, I think that's the classic definition of a detention, but not an arrest. An arrest, certainly the classic definition, and I go back to what I opened with, is that someone who is stopped and cited, whether they're in a car or for jaywalking or whatever, their experience will not be that they were arrested. No one would call that an arrest. It's only in the most technical sense would that ever be called an arrest.
Are you asking us to use the dictionary definition of arrest? Because arrest is not defined in the guidelines, and the Supreme Court cases have not given a clear definition of arrest. They've given multiple definitions of arrest that include what Judge Rawlinson was saying and include formal custodial arrest. So are we looking at the dictionary definition, or are you going to propose a definition?
I would submit, Your Honor, that the definition we use is the plain meaning. The plain meaning of arrest is understood.
And so we look at the dictionary definition, right, for plain meaning?
Plain meaning or common understanding, sure. That would be one way of doing it, though.
Why wouldn't it depend, over here, why wouldn't it depend on the definition used in the jurisdiction where the incident occurred?
Well, because what we're interpreting here is the guideline provision, which applies uniformly throughout all the federal jurisdictions, which cover at least 50 state jurisdictions.
The reason I ask that is that in some jurisdictions, jaywalking might be an arrestable offense for which you can be taken into full custody in another jurisdiction, the law might say, no, you can't arrest someone for that. You can just give them a ticket and you have to let them go on their way. So I guess that's my concern, is that the same activity might have a different meaning in different jurisdictions.
Is it your understanding? Oh, I'm sorry.
Suggests to me that that's why we would want to use a uniform meaning and not defer to the patchwork of meanings that various states give them.
Is it your understanding that the Seventh Circuit's Morgan case is the only circuit case that actually deals with this issue?
It's the only case to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Okay, and in that case, Judge Easterbrook seemed to rely a lot on Wren versus the United States, did he not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there anywhere in Wren that the court actually said that a citation equals an arrest?
No, that was clearly not an issue. The only loose reference that I take Morgan was referring to was Wren's characterization of Robinson as a traffic arrest type, as the type we have here. Of course, Robinson was a full custodial arrest, so even that was a mischaracterization of that case. But with respect to the facts of Wren, that was not before the court.
Wren spoke of a seizure, did it not, as opposed to an arrest?
That's correct, Your
Honor. What's the difference?
A seizure is, there's an entire body of law related to when a seizure ripens into an arrest. A seizure, as Judge Rawlinson pointed out, is when someone is detained and doesn't free to leave. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's an arrest. A Terry stop is a seizure, but it's not an arrest.
So really it sounds like what we have to wrestle with here is that we're dealing with the quantum of restraint involved, and it's kind of an elastic situation. Wouldn't you agree?
In some sense, but it's more than the quantum of restraint. It's the impact of the encounter. That is a citation, as the Supreme Court has noted, it involves just a momentary, brief, non-adversarial encounter.
Isn't that a factual issue? Berkemer says there's a sliding scale. It could start as a citation, and then somehow it slides into custody. And so we have to do a case-by-case review looking at the totality of the circumstances, at least for Miranda purposes, whether it becomes custodial or not. So how do we deal with that? Would every one of these cases have to be reviewed for the totality of the circumstances as to whether a reasonable person would have thought he was had the amount of restraint that was associated with a custodial arrest?
Your Honor, that generally that's going to be very clear. If someone is cited and then leaves, that will not be custodial. Someone is handcuffed, taken to the police station and fingerprinted, that would be custodial.
So would you say any time someone is stopped for a citation and subsequently is not taken to the station, that would not be an arrest or custodial, even for purposes of Miranda?
I don't know about for purposes of Miranda, but certainly for purposes of this case, I suggest that that's a very easy line to draw.
Do you make a distinction between arrest and custodial for purposes of Miranda? In other words, could you be arrested when you're not in custody?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, for purposes of Miranda, to be honest. I suspect that, I mean, since Miranda requires some amount of custody, that's not possible. But like I said previously, the line here is between a custodial arrest and a citation, which I think is a very easy line to draw.
Sorry. What about a search incident to an arrest? Are the police entitled to search upon giving a traffic citation?
No, that's the very case. Knowles provides that. And as Judge Bennett pointed out, the first sentence in that case characterized a case as one involving a citation and not an arrest. So the Supreme Court in Knowles was very, at least used those words to me. I mean, use, recognize that there's a difference, a clear difference between a citation and an arrest.
Can I ask you the following? Let's assume, over here, let's assume that I'm stopped for speeding and I'm given a $200 fine for speeding. So I was, you know, I was really speeding.
Not anymore.
Does the $200 fine count as a sentence? This is to say, this guideline applies only to sentences, so I'm trying to figure out what counts as a sentence for various traffic violations. Does a $200 fine count as a sentence?
No. There has
what counts as a sentence?
There has to at least be a sentence of probation that is over 6 months or 30 days.
So probation meaning either jail time or probation of jail time?
Yes.
I see. So a fine is never a sentence for this purpose.
That's correct. The guideline only counts sentences, and a fine never counts.
So for purpose of this guideline, we don't need to concern ourselves with ordinary traffic citations that result in, you know, speeding and jaywalking and so on. If the only thing that happens to me is a fine, this guideline never operates.
That's correct.
As I read the guideline, what it's really concerned with is recidivism and putting traffic to one side. It says, listen, if you do something, you get caught for it, you get arrested for it, and then you go do it again, we'll count those things as two sentences, even though they may be charged in the same document, even though you may be sentenced on the same day. Those are separate sentences if you were caught for the first one and then you did it again. Whereas if you do two or three crimes, you get caught once, then you move on to the second part of the guideline. Well, what happened here is he gets caught, that is to say he gets stopped, for something that's serious enough to merit imprisonment. In fact, he was imprisoned. Mm-hmm. He then gets caught again for doing exactly the same thing. So it sounds to me as though this fits within the underlying purpose of the guideline. That is, he's a recidivist. He was caught for a crime punishable by imprisonment. Indeed, he was later imprisoned for it. And then he does it again. So why is this not an arrest within the sort of the structure and purpose of the guidelines?
I agree, Your Honor, that the purpose of the guideline is to identify someone who's likely to reoffend. And to that end, what this implements is some concept of deterrence. That is, if someone, and you said gets caught, but I suggest it has to be more than gets caught. There has to be some attendant serious consequence.
Such as imprisonment.
Such as custody.
Which he got. Well, later imprisonment.
Later, but if he had gotten if he had been put in custody after his first citation, I suggest that may have had a deterrent impact, and he might not have gotten the second citation. At least that's the principle that informs this guideline. That is, the someone who reoffends after an arrest, and I suggest that arrest means a custodial arrest because that makes much greater impression than someone who is merely cited and goes on their merry way, which happens to the majority of normal law-abiding citizens. And just as common sense would tell you, that is much less likely to have an impact or deterrent effect on you than if you were, for the same offense, hauled off into custody, taken to jail, handcuffed. That you would remember that, and that would make you less likely to commit a new offense. And if you did commit a new offense after that, then that suggests that you're in some ways not able to be rehabilitated, which is what this guideline is trying to predict.
Does it make any difference that these were only 2 days apart, and we don't, in this record, you don't know whether it was a weekend or whether he could have gotten a license in between?
It's interesting. Well, I don't know that it has any legal significance. It suggests that, you know, he felt like he had to drive, and he had the misfortune of apparently not being a very good driver, so he just stopped.
He didn't have a license, huh?
Pardon?
There may have been a reason why he didn't have a license.
That's possible, Your Honor.
Mr. Conklin, do we know if a citation can only be issued in the field? That is, the officers take the person into custody and at the station house decide, well, we're just going to issue a citation?
I'm not totally familiar with California law. I suspect that there's nothing that stops that, and that would present a closer case on Smith if he was taken into custody and then presumably to arrest him. Otherwise,
they don't have to book him, right?
Pardon?
The police don't have to book somebody that they bring into the station. They can simply choose not to book for whatever reason and release them right there.
Yes, that's true.
They can decide not to press charges or can decide they don't have enough space and in the holding tank and release citation. I'm sure that's possible.
Certainly that's possible. That's probably closer to custodial arrest, and if that were the case, I'm not sure that...
What about somebody who is stopped on suspicion of drunk driving and fails, or the police believe he fails a field sobriety test and then refuses a breathalyzer? This is for sort of complex but not all that uncommon. And my understanding, at least in California, is that if that happens, the person has to be taken to custody, which means in handcuffs, taken down to the jail to be administered a blood test. If you select a blood test rather than a breathalyzer. Breathalyzer can be given in the field. Blood test, because it's a medical procedure, has to be done in a hospital or by a medical, you know, by a medically trained person. So the consequence is that the person is then taken to the hospital in handcuffs. How would that play out? Would that be an arrest in your view?
That's looking to me like it's custody and an arrest. He's taking the handcuffs. He's...
Is it a handcuff test? Is it the bracelets? Did they put the bracelets on you there? Then it's an arrest?
It's all of the...
Or is it if you get transported from the scene, an arrest?
Certainly transporting from the scene is generally a factor that weighs heavily in a custodial determination in the Miranda context. And I see no reason why that wouldn't possibly be determinative here. But, of course, that's not this case. We're talking about the easy case where it's clear that he was cited and there was no arrest, no custody, nothing more than just a traffic citation.
Counsel, do citations in California contain a bail amount as part of the citation?
I believe so, Your Honor. I haven't got one lately, but I think that's true.
And so what of what import is that bail is set?
I don't believe it's of any import with respect to whether he's been arrested.
Isn't that usually a component of an arrest, release on bail?
That's true. Release on bail does go with a traditional arrest, but I think that doesn't change that there was no custody, which... is what I submit is determinative here, is an arrest equals custody.
Yeah. Although bail in those circumstances is a sort of a misnomer. It's called bail, but what it really is that's the fine.
Well, but if you don't pay it, then you go to jail. So it's not the fine in the classic sense. It's a guarantee that you are going to appear in court or...
Right, or not, choose not to contest and forfeit the bail, but you're actually paying a fine.
Do you make anything out of the fact that in the first part of the guideline, when they're talking about sentences, and then it jumps to whether there's an intervening arrest, and then when you go to the subsection C1, it talks about certain kinds of sentences, which includes driving with a suspended license. Do you think from a statutory or an interpretive point of view that you should make any connection then between the arrest portion of the initial part of the guideline and the fact that the sentence portion talks specifically about suspended license?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the notion in the second part is that certain types of offenses are right on the edge of whether we consider them serious enough to count in criminal history. And this is right on the edge. So, whereas the intervening arrest language sort of goes more towards the concept of deterrence and recidivism, irrespective of the seriousness of the offense, that language applies equally to serious offenses as it does to less serious offenses.
Counselor, I'm going to seize a little bit of where Judge Ikuda was going. I was trying to determine what arrest meant. And as I understand it, the arrest is not defined in the guidelines. So we're left to deal with arrest. So I went to Black's Law Dictionary. And when I went to Black's Law Dictionary, it suggests that arrest is, number one, a seizure or forcible restraint. And number two, the taking or keeping of a person in custody. Are you suggesting I ignore number one and use number two?
Are you then
suggesting that this is a statutory interpretation question that we should make that decision?
It's a guideline interpretation question where you absolutely have to decide what arrest means. A legal dictionary contains a definition, a technical definition that is not used by pretty much anyone else.
So you're suggesting that we then go to the regular dictionary?
The regular dictionary, or even the sense that...
What does the regular dictionary suggest?
I think
I looked at the regular dictionary, it said to seize a person by legal authority or warrant and then take into custody.
That's right. That's what I have to. I don't know that we got the same dictionary, Judge, but it said the same thing.
But I think before we go through the dictionary, what we have to do is step back and what does the word mean? How do people use the word?
Some
words you don't need to go to the dictionary for. You can just say, this is what an arrest is. What do I understand an arrest?
So it's a man. Are you saying it's a man on the street interpretation and more person on the street?
The common understanding, it's a plain meaning. We don't have to resort to secondary sources if the meaning is clear.
Do I go to my precedent? There was a precedential definition as well, which would be more what you would seem to go for. The bottom line is I'm supposed to be interpreting here that common meaning of the man. I guess I'm arrested a lot more than anyone else when I'm stopped, because if anybody, the police stopped me, I wouldn't dare to leave. Got to be a judge. Now I know the law. I can just say, belonging on you.
But would you
say
in an interview...
My truck.
My background includes being arrested 10, 15 times.
Oh, it does?
But no one would consider that an arrest. And if you don't... If the meeting is plain, then you don't need to resolve
it. I guess if you asked the audience here how many have gotten a ticket, you'd have a number of people raise their hands. And if you ask the audience who's gotten arrested, you probably have a lot fewer hands. Yeah, right?
I suspect you're right, what
you're trying to say. The problem with dictionary definitions, of course, is that they have to cover the waterfront. And you know that arrest applies to ships, too. It does. There's a procedure in maritime law about arresting a ship. Now, you don't put handcuffs on it. You don't take it and put it behind bars. But there was really a dictionary, of course, would have to cover that definition of arrest as well.
Cardiac arrest.
Arrested development.
And my last question in this regard, do I, in this situation, give the defendant the benefit of the doubt?
That was my last point that I wanted to make before I sat down, is that to the extent that there is a dispute, and I suggest there isn't any realistic dispute here.
Well, we wouldn't be here if there weren't a dispute. So.
I guess you're right.
Do you want to save the 5 minutes or so you got left for rebuttal?
Yes, but the rule of lenity would...
Unless there's more questions. Mr. Raphael.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael Rafael on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, in this case, the question is what arrest means in this context, what the Sentencing Commission intended it to mean in this particular guideline. Judge Fletcher identified the underlying purpose of this particular guideline, which is to identify a greater propensity for recidivism, a defendant who has been confronted by law enforcement with his wrongdoing, and after that confrontation reoffends,
The word in this guideline is not confront. The word is arrest.
Yes, Your Honor, but the underlying purpose is if a defendant has been confronted by law enforcement, then he reoffends. He's shown less respect for the law, maybe an inability to restrain his own conduct. It's worse than the other situation. The commission distinguishes sort of a crime spree where a defendant does, you know, serial offenses without being caught. And that's the underlying purpose.
Counsel, if you were filling out a security clearance form that asked you to list convictions and arrests, do you think that a person would be committing perjury or some other serious offense by not listing traffic citations that got fines only?
No, if we tried to prosecute someone for that sort of false statement, the courts should throw that out as, you know, not sufficient. The question is, in this context, what the commission intended, and one should not, in that context, ask the man on the street what arrest means. One should look at the structure and purpose of the guideline.
Mr. Rafael, okay, can we rely on what the Supreme Court says?
You can, but the Supreme Court hasn't decided this particular
question. Well, they haven't, but they've certainly defined the definitions between an arrest and someone being cited, have they not?
That has been used in a couple different...
For example, in the Berkmer case, the court said, state laws governing when a motorist detained pursuant to a traffic stop may or may not be issued a citation instead of taken into custody vary significantly, but no state requires that a detained motorist be arrested. Do you think they didn't know what they were talking about?
No, in that context, which is Miranda warnings, they did make that distinction. And they also use the term throughout that opinion, formal arrest. Most of the place where you...
How about in Knowles versus Iowa?
They used the term, I think, custody arrest or full custody arrest, which...
They said that the police officer stopped Petitioner Knowles for speeding but issued him a citation rather than arresting him. Yeah. But was that a Miranda warning?
Well, that was a search incident to arrest case, Your Honor, and that the court is coming at it from a Fourth Amendment context, not from sort of the platonic definition of arrest and saying what is a search incident to arrest. The court is looking at the Fourth Amendment interest in determining where it is proper to search.
So that's from the government's perspective, that is the line of demarcation. If it's incident to the Fourth Amendment, we don't care what the Supreme Court says about whether someone is arrested or they're given a citation.
You're on my position, which is the same as Judge Phillips had here when the defendant cited Berkmer to her. She said, you're giving me cases, I'm paraphrasing, you're giving me cases from another context, from the Fourth Amendment context. She rejected their intervening arrest argument because she said that's another context. So that, in the Terry stop context, Your Honor, this court doesn't use the Supreme Court's definition. This court looks at whether the detention went further than a Terry stop. In a Terry stop, which is unreasonable suspicion, the police, of course, have to release the defendant immediately once they've done their investigation. And if you hold them a little bit longer, maybe put them in the back of the squad car, that's enough for a Terry stop.
So where do we look for a definition? Because the guidelines don't provide one. So what is the source, and how do we know that that's the right source?
Well, I agree with, you know, Judge Bennett's dissent here in the section where he talks about arrest having chameleon-like qualities and there being a lot of different definitions. I like the dictionary definitions that Judge Smith and Judge Ikuda referred to. That's one to use. But because there's all these possible definitions, one needs to look at the purpose of the statute, the need for uniformity, the way that this works in practice, and determine what did the commission.
If there are numerous potentially applicable definitions, all of which have some decent sense behind them, why wouldn't the rule of lenity apply if the guidelines themselves haven't given us a hint?
Because the rule of lenity, it's not an abstract question. The rule of lenity would apply if someone just threw this court the word arrest and said, what does it mean? But this is in a particular context. And there the law is the court. This court has to grab every possible interpretive tool, including purpose and structure, and that sort of thing, and exhaust those. And if after that it's left with nothing more than a guess, as the Muscarella Supreme Court case said, then you apply the rule of lenity.
So what's the definition then?
The definition then, for this purpose, would be
so
a defendant
who's... You're writing the opinion, and we're going to define for purposes of the guideline what arrest means.
I like the one in Judge Bennett's opinion that arrest occurs when a public officer acting under legal authority detains an individual to answer for a criminal offense, or the one to seize a person by legal authority or warrant. Just the seizure, either of those, because...
What if he gets stopped for a sobriety check? A sobriety checkpoint?
I think that's a Terry stop, Your Honor. It's not probable cause in connection with a specific charge. The specific charge is important here because... That's not an arrest.
That's your answer?
Yes, a Terry stop.
So you come up to the point and the officer looks in the window. It's happened to you, I'm sure. It's happened
yes.
to me.
Yes.
And they look in the window and say, have you been drinking? And you say, I had a beer with dinner. Not you, but...
Right.
And at that point, if I understand correctly what happens next, is he says, pull over and step out of the car. And touch your nose, and I'm going to find this flashlight in your eyes, and follow the flashlight with your eyes, and stand on one foot, and... count backwards from 99, right?
Right.
Or so I'm told. Right? That's what happens. Now, if during that, any time at that point, you say, I don't feel like it, officer. I think I would rather go home. Can you do that?
I think no, because that is, I believe...
It would be a bad idea.
It would be a bad idea.
To try. You would not advise, you are there sort of advising a person. You would not say, hey, make a run for it.
I certainly would not, and I think that's within...
And even politely declining would not be advised. It would not be something that is just, I don't really feel like playing this game with you. I just soon do something else.
In that or any Terry stop context, so long as you're within the bounds of a Terry stop.
Well, you call it a Terry stop as if, that's sort of a magic term. But the fact is they can keep you there for a fairly long time while they figure out whether or not, if they say, look, we're not satisfied with the way you walk the line or, they have a series of tests they give you. They can say, okay, now are you willing to take a breathalyzer? And you say, well, let me think about it, right, because you want to give yourself lots of time to breathe and think about it. And during that time you can't leave, right?
That's right.
Now, as you rolled up to there and the police stopped you, you are no different from anybody else. You just happen to have bad fortune to, and this happens more often at holiday time. If it's a holiday evening or something, and they will put up roadblocks. Now, there's no suspicion at all. You're just a guy driving a car. And at that point, you're saying during the entire procedure, in your view, you're not under arrest? Or you are under arrest, or what do you when they finally let you go, and you are then sitting there having a beer with your wife or something? Do you then say, hey, what happened to me? I was under arrest.
There is a point in that scenario where the officers have exceeded their authority because they've kept you too long. This circuit's test in that class.
But I've nothing I've said. I mean, of course, if they exceed their authority at that point, I'm saying they just go through the normal procedure, and the normal procedure takes some time and can take something upwards of 15 or 20 or 25 minutes, depending on how cooperative you are. Let's say they do a check of your driver's license and the computers are down or there's lots of traffic because it's one of those evenings when the airwaves, you know, whatever they do to check the computers, there are lots of calls coming in and it takes them a while to get back a warrant check on you. Mm-hmm. They keep you there and you can't leave, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Are you under arrest under your view? And then eventually, after all the dust clears, all of that is done, they say, thank you very much, sir. You may leave.
The answer basically is no, you're not under arrest. There is a point
But that is certainly fits within the definition of that my colleagues have read, right? Definition number one.
But I don't think that there's any...
Does it or does it not? You have been stopped by a police officer. You are not free to leave. You are within his power, and you will stay there until he releases you.
Right.
And it is an appreciable amount of time. It's just not just enough to pat you down or anything like that. We're not talking about a chunk of your life, upwards of 15 minutes and half an hour.
Right.
I'm sure this something like this hasn't happened to you, but you probably have friends to whom this has happened, so you know what I'm saying is realistically true.
Yes, but you're under this court's case law. It's not an arrest so long as it's within the Terry stop.
But you have to concede that we can't really go by the dictionary definition that you relied on, because if we did, that would include this situation as well. If we include the full dictionary
definition. My point is that among the possible definitions of arrest and the dictionary definitions are the one that I'm asking the court to apply here, which is in connection with a particular charge.
Well, but Mr. Tanakis is also in there. So what's so good about yours as opposed to his?
Because you have to pick what makes sense in this context.
Well, let's makes sense,
yes.
You are out ahead of me. I'll wait if you want. If it makes sense, how do I then read Douglas versus Booter? Because Douglas v. Booter says, this is the Supreme Court talking, even if it were clear that respondent had declared Missouri law to be that a traffic citation is the equivalent of an arrest, we would have to conclude that under the rationale of Bowie versus Columbia, the unforeseen application of that interpretation in this case before us deprived the petitioner of due process.
And what context was that in, Your Honor?
On the context that the Missouri court, or the Missouri statute, the Missouri, if you will, people in your particular situation want to make traffic citation an arrest.
Well, I think, for example, if the context is the sort of lying on a form context, then one cannot hold someone responsible
well,
for
so
not
you want
an arrest.
Me to look at... I mean, in this particular situation, the fact that they wanted to make this citation the equivalent of arrest was the only way they could get to where they wanted to go. And the Supreme Court said, it's a 1973 case. I'm probably old enough to know about that, and others aren't. But 1973 case, it seemed pretty much on point.
Well, I think that this context is what's important, and the purpose of getting at recidivism here is what the court should be looking at first. The second thing the court
and if that's really what we ought to be going at, then I guess I want to look at comment 3 of the guidelines. Because it seems to me that comment 3 of the present guidelines, the upward departure provision, allows someone who couldn't have his sentence counted to then allow the judge to upward depart because of the fact that the sentence could not count. In other words, seeming to be exactly what would apply in this situation because there wasn't an arrest. Because it says, counting multiple prior sentences as a single sentence may result in a score that underrepresents the seriousness. If I'm going to count these all the same, just because there's a citation, I wouldn't even need an upward departure.
Your Honor, that note 3, the Commission's problem with the intervening arrest test from the beginning has been that it might undercount a defendant's criminal history. For example, if the defendant engaged in a spree of bank robberies where there was no arrest, and then those are consolidated together.
Well, that's not exactly what this says. It says, for example, if a defendant were convicted of a number of serious nonviolent offenses committed on different occasions. And as I read the guideline, this is a particular sentence that would get a count normally, but in this particular case would not get a count. So it's serious but nonviolent, and therefore we would upward depart if we thought it was necessary. But if we count it, there's no reason for any upward departure.
Well, I believe that guideline is meant for situations where the multiple, where there is no intervening arrest, and doesn't sort of answer the question.
Well, it is meant for when there wasn't any intervening arrest, just like this one, just a citation.
But what's most important for in the departure and variance context, Judge Smith, I think, is 4A1.3, which authorizes both upward and downward departures for overstatement or understatement of criminal history. And note either 2 or 3 of that guideline provides a specific example of a downward variance, departure, where the defendant has 2 misdemeanors that he gets criminal history points for. And
well, this really talks of upward departure provisions. So
yes, again, my view is that that's meant for a series of offenses where the commission's concerned that the intervening arrest test, because there is no intervening arrest, counting them all as one will understate the criminal history.
Can I go back to your definition of arrest? I'm just trying to understand what it is. Does it have a temporal component?
It has a temporal component because it has to be intervening. It has to be after the first.
Correct.
Of
I'm
the
asking
two offenses.
The word arrest.
It comes from the word intervening in this context. That
well, there has to be an intervening arrest, but does the fact of whether something is an arrest, does it matter how long the person was stopped for?
In this context, I don't think it matters.
So let me ask you this. Would it be accurate if I were to adopt your view that the statute or the guideline would read separated by an intervening police stop? Would that be accurate in your view?
I think that that's a little too broad, because I think that that would create the problem that Judge Kosinski's questioning was getting at. That would seem to indicate the commission wants to count the Terry stop type context where there's not probable cause on a particular charge. I mean, here the point is there's a particular charge. The defendant has been caught face to face, sort of given a timeout, and he reoffended. The defendant gets multiple.
You keep going to this purpose, but the difficulty is that that's not how the guideline is written. So that's why I'm concerned about the rule of lenity. But to get there, I need to know what does arrest mean. And I haven't quite gotten, or I don't think I quite understand from you what your definition of arrest is. Maybe you could just tell us again so I can make sure we're on the same page of what you're saying.
A detention, however brief, based on probable cause for a particular charge.
You've talked a bit about.
So let me get back. So it has to be not a reasonable suspicion, taking out the Terry situation. It has to be probable cause.
Right.
And so what if the detention begins as a Terry stop, but morphs or matures into the ability to issue any kind of criminal or even in some cases these are civil infraction notices, then that is it's probable cause in your view?
Yes, because the defendant is being confronted with the particular charge, and that should be what matters here. By the way, you know, traffic infractions in general don't count under the guidelines. Speeding example.
Correct.
Under 4A1.2C. It's only this one's a misdemeanor here, and it's the commission's policy judgment of driving with a suspended license.
They exclude a normal traffic, although they include leaving the scene of an accident and things
yes.
that are more
egregious.
And a defendant does get multiple points for the if they're, you know, this defendant has other driving with suspended license convictions that he got points for. They just weren't consolidated for sentencing, so they're not at issue here. So a defendant can rack up a lot of points for this particular offense. And then, and Judge Phillips again hit the nail on the head with this, after rejecting the defendant's intervening arrest argument, she said, if your points were only accumulated based on traffic, on this sort of driving with suspended license violation, well, then I wouldn't be so concerned with your criminal history. I think she was indicating that she might vary downward. But then she said, but you have, you know, drug offense, gun offense, burglary, so, you know, I'm concerned. I'm going to give you the 21-month sentence that's more. And that's the way this should be regulated. There's sort of no perfect way to distinguish which cases should count together and which should not. For every purpose, one has to look to the variance and departure provisions and allow both the defendant and the government to argue, well, in this particular case, the criminal history category is overstated.
Counsel, yes. We know about this history because it was in the probation report, is that right?
Yes, it's in the PSR.
And how does, what kind of information goes into the probation report? I take it they wouldn't know about a Terry stop, but where you...
Yeah, wouldn't. And one problem here, the manageability of this is, if the court were to buy the defendant's argument here, there is a manageability problem, which is that counsel would have to go, you know, in any of these situations where there's consolidated cases, any misdemeanor, not just driving with suspended license, any misdemeanor in California, for example, there's authority to do a cite and release. You know, counsel would then go and try to research what happened, and the court would have to make a decision as to whether there was an arrest or not. Here, if you look around paragraph 25 of the pre-sentence report, there's another driving with suspended license where this defendant was put in the back of a squad car for a while because they were investigating whether the car was stolen. It was missing license plates. That, you know, probably would be an arrest by, you know, I think the defendant's definition.
I doubt it. Not if it came, that wouldn't necessarily be an arrest. In fact, we see cases like that where there's arguments that people have been arrested, and the police say, no, we're continuing our investigation. You're not fully arrested yet. We haven't told you that you're not going to be free to go, but we ask you to sit back here for security reasons. You know, or you detain people behind a car because you're worried about security.
Yeah.
You often say that's not an arrest, but yeah. I think your point is that you would be looking into individual circumstances in everything. That's a citation.
Sure. Well, I think it's got, even by the defendant's definition, it's got to be an arrest, I think, if the defendant is brought in for booking, which can be done in any misdemeanor, you know, and then released. And my sort of policy point is there's no, you know, the difference, that what should be driving this is defendant's being confronted with his law breaking. And the uniformity point I want to make is it makes no sense to kind of distinguish one defendant from another based on how the officer exercised his or her discretion, what the law is in the particular county or city or state, once one has decided to treat certainly, you know, full custody arrests as arrests.
You know, you've used the word confront again, so let me give you a hypothetical that uses confront without citation. He stopped for driving without a license, stopped, discovers he doesn't have a license. The officer says, you know, you're driving without a license and you shouldn't do this. Does not issue him a citation, but he does stop him, and then later issues him the citation. Was that an arrest when he stopped him and said, you know, you're driving without a license, but I'm not going to cite you right now? Was that an arrest? He confronted him.
Yes.
But he didn't cite him.
I think I would say no, because I would agree that if the defendant sort of issued a complaint or a summons where he's not present, that doesn't count as an arrest.
Well, the usage of the citation, it's a small town.
Yeah.
On day one, he stops him, discovers he's driving without a license, yeah, and he says, listen, this is a real problem. I'm not going to cite you, but don't do it. 2 days later, catches him again driving without a license, and he says, okay, I'm citing you for both of them now, and he writes out two separate citations. Was that first one an arrest? He did confront him. He told him exactly what he'd done wrong. He said, I'm not writing you a citation at this time.
I think no, because I think that fits into the crime spree type reasoning of the guidelines, because there isn't actually a charge yet. It would appear in the PSR as sort of you know, on the latter date and there not being sort of an earlier
regardless, you then are not going to stand on your use of the word confront, because he clearly was confronted the first time. You want something confront plus, confront plus citation.
Once there is an actual charge and it's there in the PSR as, you know, on a particular date, then the underlying policy rationale to determine how broadly one should look at arrest should depend on, you know, the defendant has been confronted. In that situation, whichever way your hypothetical comes out, there could be a variance argument based on the underlying reasons for it, and we could, if it's not doesn't count as intervening arrest, we would argue perhaps for an upward variance because
I'm not interested in the upward variance. Yes. I'm interested in this particular guideline, and whether that first stop where he confronts him, says you're driving without a license, I'm not citing you now, whether that's an arrest, and your answer is no, even if he's cited later.
I'm answering no because there is no charge at that, at that time.
Okay. I have a question about Morgan. You remember Judge Easterbrook's opinion, Morgan?
Yes, absolutely.
You have it?
I have it on my...
I'll read you about what he says. He says a traffic stop is an arrest in federal parlance, which is strong. I mean, it was basically sort of a pivotal statement in the opinion. But he then cites Wren.
Right.
And he doesn't give a pin site. What in Wren do you think supports his statement?
I think it's where Wren says that the temporary detention...
Do you have a page?
Yes, 809.
I looked at 809, and 809 is...
It's about seizure of persons.
It's highly unhelpful. Well, it actually says the opposite thing.
Not exactly. It says that the temporary detention of individuals during the stop of an automobile by the police, even if only for a brief period and for a limited purpose, constitutes a seizure of persons within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. So I think that if it is a seizure of persons within the Fourth Amendment because the person's detained and isn't able to leave, it's not a stretch to...
What Judge Easterbrook is saying, Morgan says, in federal parlance... I mean, he says in federal parlance. This is sort of how the word arrest is used in federal parlance. And then he cites something, an opinion that, as best I can tell, never uses the word arrest. Maybe it uses somewhere else, but certainly doesn't use it there.
I am not making the argument that...
And are you saying that seizure and arrest are the same thing?
I'm saying that seizure helps inform that it is reasonable to interpret arrest in the situation where there's a seizure. I actually do disagree with that the broad statement by Judge Easterbrook that in federal parlance for all purposes, arrest includes this situation. So I do disagree with that. For this purpose, what the commission intended in this...
So you like the result, but the sort of pivotal rationale you disagree with.
Well, I don't think that's the pivotal rationale.
I don't think there's anything else in the opinion. I mean, I looked at it. It's a fairly brief opinion, and that's really all he says. He cites that, and he cites Childs, which is his own. It's another Seventh Circuit opinion, also by Judge Easterbrook.
Hey, listen, he's been around a lot. Is there anything wrong with that?
Nothing at all. I'm not disputing. You know, hey, he's been around longer than some of us. Here.
I mean, I think
so he's written a lot. So I don't have any problem with it. But even Childs is not entirely on point. But Wren doesn't help at all, right?
Well, I think it does help.
Because we're bound by Wren, if it really is, says something to it. We're not bound by the Seventh Circuit.
Well, my view is that the statement in Wren that there is a Fourth Amendment seizure in this context does help, because it helps inform that arrest is a reasonable...
Well, all arrests are seizures, but not all seizures are arrests. I think that's your position. I mean, this is the discussion you and I had and the discussion you had with some of my colleagues. You say, oh, well, if they just sort of stop you to check you out, it's a seizure because you're not free to go, but it's not an arrest.
Right.
So the universe of seizures is broader than the universe of arrests. In fact, if you're doing Venn diagrams, arrests would be completely encompassed by seizure, right? There's no part of arrest that is not also a seizure.
I think that's right. So Wren doesn't... It helps. It doesn't settle the issue where...
It doesn't help because you are we're interested in the dividing line between arrest and seizure. Right. So on that point, Wren helps not at all.
If it wasn't a seizure at all, if Wren said the other thing, if Wren said there is no seizure during a traffic stop, then that would really hurt me. Because Wren said that there is a seizure,
right.
I think
so,
it helps.
So the most you can say about Wren is it doesn't hurt you.
It helps a bit. Okay. It doesn't settle everything. What settles everything is the purpose, the need for uniformity, not based on...
You know, I'm not going to accept that. How does it help even a little bit?
It help.
How does it help? Since we know that all arrests are seizures, right? So
yes.
How does Wren help define the dividing line? And if you are a seizure but not an arrest, you lose. Then how does it help police the dividing line between arrest and seizure?
I think having that necessary condition, a seizure for an arrest, helps because then it can be an arrest. It doesn't settle the issue as to whether it's an arrest, but it helps because the Supreme Court said there is a seizure. My time's up. I want to make one more point related to Morgan, if I could, which
go ahead.
I'll do as quickly as I can. Which is Morgan was decided in 2003. Sentencing Commission, as the court knows from its comments, from its Appendix C commentary on the guidelines, has been reviewing criminal history closely. Has changed this particular guideline and elevated the intervening arrest requirement. The commission watches case law closely. One would know, it has, Morgan is cited in secondary sources, it's like the Federal Sentencing Reporter. The commission has not chosen to do anything to say that Morgan was decided wrong. When you're looking at what the commission intended by arrest, the fact that Morgan exists and the commission has not acted in any way to say that that's wrong, to change its guidelines or its commentary, should be a factor this court considers and not split from the Seventh Circuit and say that the Seventh Circuit decided it wrong and the commission meant something else. Thank you,
Your Honor. Mr. Tanaka, I think you had about 5 minutes left, if you wish to take it.
I think I'll just address that last point made by Mr. Rafael, and that is that's an awful lot of weight to put on inaction in this context, and I don't think it bears that. There's no indication at all that the Sentencing Commission knows about Morgan or chooses to do anything about a stray Seventh Circuit decision out there. Second, the commission did change the guideline, as I noted initially, to take out the relatedness aspect of this section, and Morgan does talk about the relatedness aspect as part of its rationale. So from that standpoint, maybe they did address at least they undercut the Morgan rationale.
Can I just ask one question? Do the guidelines use the word arrest in any other guideline?
I think I indicated in the 28J letter that they use the word arrest in the it's in a number of guidelines, but the closest one where it could be used, you could gather that there was some difference between an arrest and a citation or detention is the one that I cited, which said that if you impersonate someone for the purpose of arrest, detention, or something else, then you increase the offense level. So they separated arrest and detention in that context. There's also a provision in the upward departure guideline that said that you can't upwardly depart based on someone's prior arrest record, which, although doesn't distinguish between the two, suggests that they're using it in the most natural context. As the government pointed out, that no one would expect that you would you would list a traffic citation as a part of your prior arrest record. So in the only areas where the term is used that shed any light at all, I think it tends toward Mr. Lyle Felix's interpretation.
Mr. Duncan, if we would agree with your position, is there any way Mr. Lyle Felix would benefit from such a rule?
He was released in October. He was given the maximum 3 years of supervised release, so that he still has over 2.5 more years to go.
On supervised release. On resentencing, could the judge take that into account?
Yes. This court's case law says that a sentencing issue isn't moot or because If you vacate the sentence and order resentencing, he can take that into account. She can take that into account and take it off the term of supervised release.
One other question that Judge Schroeder raised. If one were to look at, if you look at simply the probation officer's report, the initial report, there's no mention in the listing of the prior conviction of the citation. That only appears when the probation officer submits a response to objections to the PSR. Is that really, is that a problem, like Mr. Raphael says, to do that for defense counsel? I mean, how is it that we were able to, defense counsel was able to identify this, or somebody was able to identify these particular convictions as having been derived from a citation? There are two other driving on a suspended license convictions that are not treated as citations.
They well could have arisen from citations, but since they received separate sentences, it's sort of immaterial. In this case, there are a couple things. One, just the proximity strongly suggests that he wasn't in custody. And second, defense counsel, I assume, spoke with his client about it and was able to represent.
The probation officer mentioned the copy of the citation, of the arrest. I'm just curious, these are awfully old.
Yeah, and they didn't have any documentation. And I think the probation officer used the term, you know, I requested the arrest report. That's probably a really loose use of the term, because there is no, well, I suspect, no arrest report, because there was a citation.
I requested the arrest report, but none was provided.
Right, because it doesn't exist, because it was a citation.
I'm just curious.
Okay. Any further?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Case is argued, stands submitted. We're adjourned.